Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's October 9th, 2020. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Another Chris, week, another white postal post.
Wow. Is that a fly on your head?
No.
Swat that thing away. Come on, buddy. I'm going to be a friend. I'm going to tell you when there's a fly on your head.
That's my buddy Jeff Goldblum.
And the best thing about that is we're not even in the same room, so I can't even see you. But I can sense the fly there.
Oh, you're just giving away all our secrets now. I'm sure they had all this, like, these fantasies of me and you, you know, on the phone, on the side, you know, looking at each other.
Queen and Garth sitting on the couch in her mom's basement. That's how we've been doing this so
far. Oh, man. So you're breaking into comedy, and I was serious. I was going right to the Mike Postle post, and you're like, no, let's break into the comedy.
Can I have a little levity?
You can see the planning that goes into our show here, folks. You know, we don't know what each other's going to do ever, really, ever.
All right, get all serious on us then, man, if you're going to bring me down.
Sorry.
Oh, okay. You want me to just start? Okay, all right.
Well, yeah, you can get serious. I'm, you know, whatever. We can talk about
each other off today, man.
Yeah, we can talk about flies all you want if you want, but let's just talk about Mike Postle.
Another week, another major turn in the case that had accused Mike Postle of cheating during Stone's Gambling Hall live stream games. Postle has sued a number of defendants, including Veronica Brill, who first raised concerns about Postle's success in the games. And poker media personalities like Joey Ingram and Doug Polk, who posted numerous videos they say prove Postle is guilty. ESPN, which aired a segment on the case, is also defended in the suit that seeks $300 million in damages, Chris. A California lawsuit against Postle was thrown out, and plaintiffs who sued Stones and its tournament directors settled for a nominal payment after their lawyer said they couldn't prove Stones or the tournament director was in any way involved. Brill has raised thousands of dollars from poker players on GoFundMe for her upcoming legal expenses.
That's a personal. That amount of money right there that he's suing for, that's reasonable, right?
Yeah, well, of course.
Perfectly reasonable. Right? Yeah. $300
million. $300 million. Yes. So this thing, it is the story that keeps on giving, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Just when you think it can't get any crazier,
never stops.
And again, I admit I am easily marketed, and if I'm getting sucked in to keep talking about this documentary that he has coming out, because he's doing this crazy stuff to get me sucked in to talk about this documentary, guilty as charged, right?
So, yeah.
Because at this point, I need to see that. I need to see that documentary tomorrow, right? I want to know what this guy thinks is so earth-shattering that's going to rock the entire world, not just the poker world. And he must think it must be if he's suing for $300 million. So,
yeah, like let's get to that for a minute. How do you settle on that amount? Reasonable people will be like, okay, this guy can't work for the rest of his life. He was probably going to make $40,000 to $50,000 a year times 30 years. How do you come up with $300 million? Even if he made $1 million a year for the rest of his life, he's still not getting to the $100 million mark. So, how do you come up with $300 million in damages? You know, it's unbelievable, that amount.
Dartboard, probably, right?
Dartboard. Oh, man.
Well, come on. I mean, in fairness, I mean, when you sell your car online, right, you sell it for $15,000, even though you're going to settle for $10,000, right? So he probably said, hey, I need $200 million, so I'm going to seek $300 million, right? So he's some room to negotiate.
Wait, you know, I'll do a reversal of last night's debate and say, when I saw $300 million, I thought it was $300. And then I thought it was maybe $300,000. $300 million? Well, come on.
All right, so we're having some fun with it because we should have some fun with it. But, you know, here's the thing again. And, again, there still has not been a court that has said that Postol is guilty, right?
Right.
We have all these people that he sued who have said it's without doubt he did, which is why he's suing them right now. So, I don't harbor any illusions that we will ever know the truth here, right? So, but in a world, if you'll allow me to
do a
sail off to this world.
Movie trailer. In a world.
That guy's awesome, man.
He is awesome.
In a world. So in a world where he actually didn't cheat at all, what would you sue for, Chris, right? Because, I mean, you're already looking at this tournament director who we now... at least from the lawyer that sued him, said, hey, this guy didn't do anything, right? So at this point, we know that guy really took it on the chin, right?
Yeah.
So imagine, I mean, Postol obviously is the bigger perpetrator in this alleged scheme, right? So if he didn't do it, if he didn't do anything wrong, then that's even worse. So, you know, I don't know where this goes, but... That's why I really wanted to see this documentary, because, I mean, if he came up with, and again, we're just crazy talking here, but if he came up with some just crazy new way of playing poker, and he spells it out, all right, that's going to be interesting, right? Yeah. I'm sure that's not what it is.
But. No. I just don't, like, when you come up with a number like that, you know, the judge and whoever's, they're going to look at that number and they're not going to take the case seriously, and they probably just throw it out on that amount alone. I mean, it's, nobody can justify $300 million in damages unless you've lost the potential to make $300 million. And I don't care how good this documentary is, it's not making $300 million. So it's just a ridiculous number.
I don't know. It could be really good. It could be like Green Book good, right?
Green Book good. Oh, man.
Well, I think the other cautionary tale here is for folks like Joey Ingram and Doug Polk, and I'm not trying to be this silencer of freedom of speech here by any means at all. But we've talked about this at length on the show, right? The reason that we don't get into these, it's definitely guilty stuff,
yeah.
With anti-up, is because it's not because I'm afraid of getting sued. I think it's the right thing to do to not accuse somebody of something. Or convict somebody, I should say, not accuse, convict somebody of something that you can't completely prove. But it's also reckless from a legal standpoint. So, you know, we are not among these dozens of defendants in this.
Right, exactly. I thought the same thing when I saw the suit. I thought, this is why we don't do stuff like that. It's one thing, you know, if you're being an institution that is reporting on hard news and doing hard facts on things, and they can prove the facts and they have the information and the evidence to prove it up. It's another thing to just come out and say, well, we think this is what happened because we watch videos, and we're going to go out and basically, you know, crucify this guy.
And say 100% that he
cheated. Yeah, exactly.
That's really the thing. And I think this is interesting because yesterday I watched this documentary called The Lost Lincoln. Fascinating if you're a history nerd like me. Mm-hmm. But they have a photo of what they thought was a photo of Abraham Lincoln on his deathbed. So it would be, if it's authenticated, it would be the 131st known photo of Abraham Lincoln, right?
Right.
So it was a two-hour thing of a authenticator going through everything that she would do in her normal authenticating life to figure out this thing, you know, tracing the ownership of the photo, looking for the timeline of how the photo could have been taken. All this other stuff, right? It was super fascinating. And he had all these experts, including the guy from the football movie. You know, the one that Will Smith starred in, the doctor. fantastic. But and nobody except one guy. There's one guy that said it's absolutely Abraham Lincoln and a real photo. Everybody else gave you a percentage, right?
Right.
They're like, based on, you know, this and this and this, I would say it's 75% that is Abraham Lincoln, the photo. Or 80%, or 83%, right?
Right.
So that's the difference. There's a difference between coming out and going, this absolutely has to be a photo of Abraham Lincoln, versus I'm 85% sure this is a photo of Lincoln because of this and this and this. So all the videos that I watch from Ingram and Polk, there was no wiggle room, right?
Right.
They presented no wiggle room. They were 100% convinced that he was guilty. And you can't be that. You just can't be 100%. So no. It would have been a different story if they said, hey, here's the stuff. You make up your own determination, but look at this, look at this, and look at this. This is why I think you did. So.
Yeah, I agree. 100%.
100%.
I agree 100%.
And by the way, I'm pretty sure that was a photo link, and I'm convinced. But
I could put the little 100 icon, a little emoji up there for you. 100.
So, yeah, I mean, again, I'm just cautioning people out there. I mean, even in your regular life, I think, you know, I think in this country we just need to ratchet down the anger to begin with over anything. We're in the middle of an election right now, right?
Yeah.
Ratchet everything down a little bit, and I think you have a better chance of convincing people of what you're believing in if you're not so bombastic and in their face and so sure that you're right of something they can't be sure of. That's my little Mr. Rogers speech of the day.
That was nice.
And we'll see what crazy stuff comes out of this case next week on the show.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Because you know there will be, right?
Absolutely.
All right, the first event in a new tour, the Midway Poker Tour, resulted in myriad payout problems. The event this past weekend charged players an $1,100 entry fee, but Illinois charitable gaming law only allows players to be paid $500 in cash beyond their buy-in. With first place paying more than $50,000, most cashers were expecting to receive gold bars worth the difference they got in cash and their prize, more than they got in cash and their prize.
Right.
With the expectation that a gold dealer would be on site to buy the gold bars from them. Other Illinois charitable events in the past have reused the non-monetary prizes after each cash out, exposing a loophole, but the state attorney's general office insisted that organizers have enough gold bars for all cashers. Organizers found a supplier of silver to satisfy the attorney general's office demands. The supplier ultimately didn't have enough silver to do so. Tournament organizer Dan Bekovec apologized to players that the problems were out of his control and that he lost a lot of money organizing the tournament. Whew. Hopefully we can talk about this easier than I read it.
Wow. Yeah, that's tough because, one, I didn't even know this existed, like that you could do this, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I could talk more about that.
Okay, good. The gold bars thing, I didn't even know that existed, like... So you have to go out and buy gold bars and then put up the money for the gold bars, bring the gold bars, and then find somebody who wants to buy the gold bars and then say, okay, you got to be there that day because you're going to be buying $50,000 worth of gold bars. And that's crazy. All that to get around, it's like, why even do the tour there? Just do it somewhere else.
Well, yeah, but a couple things. One, I'm certainly not an expert on the charitable gaming law, but I've been friends with Kirk, the owner of Windy City Poker Championship, for a long time,
And
that's how he operates is in Illinois, as well as one of our good advertisers, Rockford Charitable Games. So I've had a lot of conversations with him about the laws and how they have to operate tournaments, and it is frustrating, but again... it's possible to run these there where it's not possible to run these in other states. Like, you can't do this here in Florida, right?
Yeah.
So if you want to, you know, be a poker operator and not have to get a gaming license like you would in any other state, including Illinois, right? This is a workaround. So, I mean, to your question, why do this here? Because this is the only place you can do it.
Hmm.
And do it like this, right?
So. Yeah.
So that being said, though, you have to honor the laws and the rules. So, I mean, and obviously this is a loophole, as it mentioned, that other folks had used in the past. So it's kind of hard to criticize him from doing something that he's probably seen or other people have seen be done somewhere else. But just because somebody else did it and didn't get caught, right, doesn't mean it's right.
Yeah.
And that's what happened here. I think that was the the domino that foiled all this is somebody actually decided to show up and say, hey, you can't do that.
Wow, that's crazy. And then, so that was the other thing, too. It's pretty bold to have an entry fee that is so much more than the $500 max buy-in. Or, you know, you could only get paid $500 more than your buy-in. it would seem to motivate people to want to have smaller buy-in tournaments to do it, so that you wouldn't have to have this kind of a problem or hassle too.
That probably would help us too. I think the other problem too is and Poker News, I think it was our correspondent Chad Holloway that wrote the article, right? They made a good point that the players that are used to playing in these Illinois events, they know the deal, right? They know they're only going to get $500 in cash on top of their entry fee, and they know they're going to get the rest in prizes or other things like that. They probably know that they might have a possibility of doing this little gold bar scam thing. Right?
Yeah.
But there were people that drove in for this event probably because they saw $1,100 entry fee, or the fact that there's a tournament when there's no real tournaments going on anywhere near there, right?
Yeah.
That came in and had no idea this is how the things work, right? Those are the folks that get really upset. So can you imagine that if you were just Joe Florida player who goes to Tampa Bay Downs and wins a tournament and gets cash, right?
Right.
Easy peasy lemon squeezy, right? And then you go somewhere else, and then you get there, and you find out, hey, the rules here mean we give you this, and then you get this, and then you go over to that guy, and he'll buy it back from you, and blah, blah, blah. You can imagine how upsetting that could be. So,
wow.
So, I wasn't on site, so I don't know how clear this organizer made that to those folks, but it certainly didn't seem clear enough.
Yeah, and it's a shame because, I mean, not that we need another tour, but, you know, it's the first event of the tour. They're trying to make their way, and then the first thing happens is this. So I don't know what their future holds, but that's, you know, it's a shame that someone's trying to do a startup, and we've been there. We know what it's like to start a new, you know, venture or whatever, and to have this happen the first time out of the gate is tough to overcome.
And really the sad thing about this too is that, again, this is all charitable gaming, right? So a portion of the entry fee has to go to a charity.
Yeah.
And it's the charity's responsibility to handle payouts. So, and that's the problem. And generally what happens is in these cases, the charity just kind of takes his marching orders from the organizer on how to do things, right? I mean, yeah. they're out, you know, helping deafness or, you know, cancer or whatever it is, right? They're not poker tour operators, right?
Right.
So, and ultimately there was a charity that got caught in the middle of this, and I think that's going to be the problem for the organizer going forward, because word's going to spread pretty quickly. I don't know if I'd want to put my charity in that situation.
No.
You know, for any amount of money, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We'll see. Definitely not the way you want to start out, though.
No, not too bad.
All right, here's this week's updates. Update on casinos and poker room reopenings. In Texas, Kickapoo Lucky Eagle Casino Hotel has reopened with poker. In Nevada, Grand Sierra Resort has reopened its poker room. In California, Capital Casino, Bicycle Casino, Commerce Casino, 500 Club, Fresno, Bankers Casino, Casino 99, Casino Club Reading, Lucky Chances Casino, Park West Casino, Lodi, Paso Robles Casino, Towers Casino, Turlock Poker Room, and Joe's Casino have reopened with outdoor gaming that includes poker. And Players Casino will reopen on October 13th, and Elk Valley Casino has reopened its poker room. And Iowa Prairie Meadows Casino Hotel has reopened its poker room. And Missouri Century Cape Girardeau has reopened its poker room. And Arizona Gila River Hotels and Casinos Wild Horse Pass has reopened its poker room. And Bucky's Casino has announced that its poker room is closed permanently. AnteUpMagazine.com/reopen lists verified details on casino and poker room reopenings. If you have any updates, email us at editor@AnteUpMagazine.com. We are also emailing a weekly e-blast with updates that you can subscribe to on the homepage at AnteUpMagazine.com.
Yeah, that's a lot of rooms. It's starting to get back to normal, except, you know, some are outside, some have plastic barriers, whatever, but it's getting there. When California is starting to open up that many rooms, you know, we're pretty close.
Yeah, and most of those, again, are outdoor. So,
right.
I mean, things will get better when they're allowed to move back inside. But I would suspect that there are players that are not comfortable going inside a poker room right now that might be tempted to go play in an outdoor environment, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it's not as bad of a thing as it would sound. And really, lots of these that I've seen, I mean, looking at a lot of these photos of them, and they've done really, really, really good jobs with building an outdoor gaming facility that looks really nice. So hats off to those folks for being creative enough to come up with a way to do that. So I think the big thing here was this Bucky's Casino is the first poker room that I've gotten confirmation is closed permanently. Now, I've had a bunch of people tell me, you know, handful of other rooms that they've heard privately are not going to reopen, or the staff have been laid off, not furloughed, but completely laid off. But this is the first one that they've actually, that I've seen, that they've actually announced that it's not coming back. So it will be interesting to see as we go forward what the actual casualty count is on poker rooms, and whether it matters either. I mean, again, we've talked about this before, that it's possible that we have too many poker rooms, and consolidation might be better for players. You know, if you can go to one, you know, casino with 30 tables rather than six casinos with five tables, you know, what's better, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, Bucky's unfortunately is out remote, so those folks, that this is not a good thing for poker players that used to play there, because now you've got a very long drive to find another place to play. But in places like Vegas and stuff, it may not be that big of a deal if we lose a couple rooms and the other rooms get stronger because of it. So,
well, the sad thing, too, is that it's another option that, like, they always hosted that Northern Arizona Texas Hold'em Championship, like, in April. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of those Arizona players and players in that area in the Southwest enjoyed that series, and now that's gone. So that stinks, because they were, you know, they actually advertised with us a bunch, too.
Yeah.
You know, every other year or something like that, but at least they were with us, and now it's just another room gone, and it's sad. I mean, like you said, does it help the situation in some ways? Yeah, it does, but you never want to see, you know, another opportunity for you to play poker be gone, especially in a series like that. It's another opportunity for them to play in a good series, but that's sad.
We'll see. Hopefully the news continues to be positive. So.
Yeah. Annie updates. Papes, the Annie Up Fans free online tournament series on PokerStars Play Money site, is available everywhere. Details on how to join can be found at bit.ly/PAIPS. Games are on the 6th, 16th, and 26th of every month and rotate disciplines, with a main tournament followed by a second chance event. PokerStars lets you claim 15,000 free chips every 4 hours. Join the Annie Up Fans group Facebook page and post within the group to get feedback on hands, ask call-the-floor questions, or just discuss anything poker. Check out our 11 vintage Annie Up logo designs on merchandise at annieupmagazine.com/shop to buy t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, phone and laptop cases, coffee and drink mugs, and more with your choice of Annie Up Magazine, Annie Up PokerCast, or Annie Up Poker Tour logos. If you hand of the week or your listener spotlight or even a call to floor submission, email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com or post in the Annie Up Fans group on Facebook. Each week we spotlight a listener who emails us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com. If they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with call to floor and hand of the week, we send them something cool. This comes from Greg Taylor. He says, "Will there ever be poker tournaments like there were once upon a time? My wife and I miss playing live tournaments. Also, we plan on a trip to Colorado soon. Any idea where we can find a great poker room there?"
Well, you can go to Illinois and play in the Midway Poker Tour, Greg.
Nice.
It's a live tournament. No, okay. In seriousness, though, tournaments are back. We Mid-States, as we reported on the show, did a very successful event in Iowa at the end of August, even. Venetian completed one in September. There's a Texas Card Club that had one recently as well, too, and I know of other ones that are coming up soon. So they're coming back. And then a lot of rooms are actually now starting their daily tournaments back up as too. I mean, some don't, but some are. So they're getting back. So just be patient. They'll be back. Now, will they be like you said there were once upon a time? They may look different going forward. That we still don't know, right? So,
right.
I'm not entirely sure that we're going to have 400 tables at the World Series of Poker in close proximity and all that kind of stuff yet. But so they might look a little different, but they're coming back. So, I mean, I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture here. I mean, there is facts to back up that tournaments are coming back. So, and then the Colorado, too. Yeah, as I mentioned, three of the four rooms in Black Hawk have reopened. Golden Gates is the tournament room there, Ameristar is the cash game room there, and then Isle Blackhawk is the smaller room of those three. And the only poker room in Cripple Creek, Midnight Row, still has not reopened yet. So those would be my suggestions for right now.
But. Very good. Find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game, and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us, and we'll have Hollywood Casino Toledo Director of Poker Elliot Schechter tell you how he would have ruled. This is Matt Hayward. Says, how do you see the verbally binding component of our game evolving over the next few years? As a school teacher, I know firsthand that the masks we wear as part of the COVID health and safety makes it so much more trickier to communicate. As such, what onus is on the dealer and the poker room to ensure that the correct verbal comment was heard? I know that it is still each player's responsibility to hear it right. The problem I have is that hearing people is not always the easiest at the best of times. Throw in masks as well as plexiglass dividers, etc., and there will be significant room for error. Do we know if the TDA is considering any rule modifications?
It's good to have Elliot back working.
Yes.
He says the simple answer is no. The TDA is not considering changing the rule for accepting a verbal action. While you make a great point, and this needs to be discussed at length at our next gathering, presumably on Zoom, most are getting our rooms back open, are not spreading a whole lot of tournaments or events. Also, safety concerns and compliance are taking up a great deal of time, along with finding more people willing to deal. By the way, check with your local poker room. There's a good chance they're hiring dealers and hosts, and they might even teach you how to deal for free. To your points, more diligence on the part of the players and dealers is now required in order to ensure that betting maintains integrity. Players acting on a bet need to wait until the chips are in the pot and the bet is clear, and bettors need to attempt to stop the action if the next player or players put in an incorrect amount in the pot. Dealers need to actually pay attention and get clarifications when necessary. Dealing on autopilot is even more of a detriment to the game than before. The TDA may strengthen the rules, but enforcing the existing rules will go a long way toward getting the job done. In the meantime, see something, say something. Now more than ever, getting it right is more important than getting it over with. Very good point there at the end.
Yeah, yeah. And it's even, no matter how hard it is to hear people or how hard it is to whatever, and you know, he said the next few years, but I don't anticipate this going on for years, but maybe it will. You know, you still have to make sure you know what's going on. If you had a low talker, like on Seinfeld, sitting in one seat and you're all the way on the other side, you know, you still have to be positive of what the bet is before you commit to it or before you raise or whatever. So, yeah, it's making it more difficult, definitely, but you still need to be positive of what the bet is before you commit. So it's just a good practice, even when there's not masks and plexiglass, you know, it's a good practice to know what the announcement was or what the raise was or whatever. So yeah, it's I don't see them changing anything. It's still a matter of being onus on you to understand and not commit to anything until you do understand.
Well, in my recommendation would be to get in the practice of confirming the bet every time. I know that sounds annoying, both to you and the other players, but it's really the best way to go. I mean, I can't tell you how horrible it is hard for my wife and I to communicate when we're both wearing our mask. I mean, like last night we were somewhere and I was asking her a question and she was answering a completely different question. She couldn't hear me, right?
So yeah.
It's just the way it is, right? So I would like to think that players would not get upset with you if every time you tell the dealer, hey, is that bet 1200? And have the dealer repeat 1200. You know, again, that's not going to solve all of them because, you know, you dealer could misunderstand you. You could misunderstand the dealer even in the confirmation part, right? But more likely than not, you're going to get it right more than get it wrong by confirming and double confirming and triple confirming. And that's kind of the way it's going to need to be.
I agree. Hey, we get to complete O'Malley's move today. Here comes part one. We'll see you on the other side.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we are playing at our regular $2, $5 No Limit Hold'em Casino Cash Game. It plays very similar to other 2-5 games, but there are some pretty massive stacks in this one. When we sat down, the biggest stack at the table was $3,000, and since we're allowed to buy in for up to half of what the biggest stack has, we bought in for $1,500. That player has since left, and we are now the biggest stack at the table with $2,200. But there are two other stacks at more than $1,500, and only one stack has less than $1,000, a short stack with about $350. We've been playing for close to 4 hours. The blinds post, the under the gun wants to straddle, but does it too late. He flips his limp in blind. The plus one folds, and the action is on us, again with 2200 and the 9 of spades, 9 of clubs. I'm going to make a raise here, knowing full well our maniac under the gun could come over the top. We make it $25 to go. It's folded to the button, who raises us to 80. He started the hand with around 1600. I wasn't expecting this. This player has been playing fairly straightforward, but hasn't yet shown down a hand. He has raised on a few occasions, and I can't remember him checking any flops. So either he's getting good cards, or he's a 100% C-better, a la Barry Greenstein. The small blind and big blind fold. The under the gun looks pained as he's trying to make his decision. After some grumbling, he folds. I like our hand, but since our opponent could have an overpair to our nines, or simply something like ace-king or ace-queen, I'm content to call and go to a flop. The pot is around 165, and the flop is the tray of hearts, tray of diamonds, deuce of hearts. This doesn't exactly crush my range, as I was a pretty early raiser and then just called. In fact, I'm pretty sure we're playing our hand mostly face up. What else could we have other than a middling pocket pair? We check. Our opponent leads out for 100. I'm not going to go away that easy, but I think getting a better hand to fold with a check raise is a little far-fetched. Plus, if he has something like ace-king or ace-queen, we kind of want to get more value out of those hands on later streets. We call. The pot is now at around 365, and the turn is the jack of diamonds. Once again, we're going to check. Our opponent takes his time counting out 200 and puts it into the pot. So, an overcard just hit the board. What's the move?
All right, another one of these gut check moments. Our opponent's play has not narrowed down our original range of an overpair beating us, or two big cards that may or may not be beating us. Therefore, we really don't know where we stand. Because of that, maybe a raise is in order to find out that answer, but you know me. Tight as a pair of spandex in an 80s rocker, so I don't think I have the squirrel nuts to do that.
So, are you calling? What are you doing?
I don't know yet. I haven't decided yet.
You have to decide. That's the whole show.
I'm obviously calling. It's just a matter of whether I'm going to raise instead.
I think in this situation, I fold quicker than a pair of parachute pants. I'm sorry. I don't know. I don't know if I call. Maybe I do. You know, now that you're changing your mind or whatever it is you're doing, I don't know. Maybe I call. I definitely do not raise. I do not raise.
I know raise seems kind of scary, but that you have to know where we are, so raising is the only way we're going to know where we are before we hit this next card. So,
yeah, wait, you're being crazy now. Wait a minute. So, the flop comes all unders to our nines, right? So, We check. He bets 100. Now, we call. Now an over comes. We check. The guy bets 200, and you're thinking about raising now? You're going to make it 600 on a pair of nines?
The argument to raise is if this guy is seeing an ace-king, ace-queen, and we've been passive through this whole thing, right? So now we can represent that jack and get that player to fold. I mean, obviously the danger is if we're up against an overpair that's higher than ours, or we're up against ace-jack, then we're screwed. But
otherwise, or a three.
We have a potential. Well, yeah, it's likely. But we have the potential here to win this hand by being the aggressor. Where we just call. We're gonna check on the. We're gonna have to check on the river, right? Unless nine comes, and then we're gonna be faced with a $400 bet. Then, right? So, I mean, what are you gonna do there? Are you gonna call? Or you're gonna be in the same situation we are in now, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to have any more information. So really, if we're calling and you're hoping for a nine, I mean, that's the only thing you can hope for. Otherwise, you know, or you're just going to call the two now and commit to calling whatever the river red is.
I don't know if I call.
An ace, a king, or a queen, that's going to be pretty scary, right? So
maybe I call. I don't know. I definitely don't raise, though. I can't make
again,
it 600.
I'm saying, I don't have the squirrel nuts to do it, but I think that's the right play. I think the right play here is to raise, but I wouldn't be able to do it.
All right. Well, I was hoping that if we checked and called that he would be less inclined to bet again on the turn. When he did bet the turn, I'm thinking, there's no way we have this guy beat now. How could he do it twice? You know. But then on the river, now we're still out of position, so even if a blank comes on the river, we have to check again, you know, because now if you make it 600 and he calls you, now on the river, you've made it 600 to go, he called, now your first act again. Are you going to commit now another 700-800 to this bluff?
Again, that's why you raise, so, I mean, that's why it's a little bit dangerous, because if you raise, I mean, again, what you're hoping by raising is he's going to fold. He's going to have ace-king, ace-queen. something like that, right?
Right.
And fold. That's the preferred outcome. But if he calls, then you've got some choices to make. I mean, if he raises you, then you know you can lay this down, right? So two of the options are great, or two of the options bring tremendous clarity to the situation. Let's say that. Yeah. One's great, one's not. The call, if he calls, that's where it gets a little murky now. But if he just called, he can't have a super strong hand, I don't think, unless he's being really tricky, right? So right. So that gives us the ability on that river to bet with a wide range of river cards coming.
All right, well, here comes part two. We'll see what happens.
Hello again. Initially, this jack looked like a bad card. But upon further review, I don't know that it's that bad. We don't block any hearts, which means our opponent could be doing this with a flush draw. Perhaps ace-queen of hearts or ace-king of hearts. We only lose to ace-jack of hearts in this scenario. Does ace-jack suited re-raise pre-flop to a raiser in the MP? The only hand containing a jack that I can think of that might raise an MP raiser is jack-jack. And after that turn, I think he'd want to check to induce a bluff on the river. This could possibly be something like aces, kings, or queens, maybe tens, but at some point these hands would slow down, right? Would they triple barrel? I'm going to formulate a plan here. I'm going to call, and whatever the river is, I'm checking. If he triple barrels, we might have to fold, but I'm under the impression our opponent won't go for that third street of value with a better hand, or a third barrel with a bluff. We call. The pot is 765, and the river is the six of spades. We follow our plan and check. Our opponent looks at our stack, checks it against his, checks his cards, sighs, then announces ace-king, and tables the ace of diamonds, king of hearts. We table our nines and win a nice pot. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, in poker, it's best to look ahead. Getting a sense for what this guy was going to do on the river dictated my action on the turn. I hope to see you on the felt.
All right, I'd be interested to see what would have happened had we had the squirrel nuts to raise on the turn. Our opponent couldn't have called there, could he?
No way. There's no way he calls if we raise that turn. He's got absolutely nothing, and we're raising to 600. There's no way, unless he's absolutely convinced that he can push us off our hand and shoves to give us the impression that he has jacks full or a pair over the jacks. And even that, he still has to be wary of us having a three just because we could be any old random player, you know. I mean, we could raise with ace-three suited. He doesn't know what we had preflop. So, yeah, there's no way he calls if we had the squirrely nuts. But I was shocked he had ace-king. I thought for sure that second bet. It's tough to make that bet when you have someone raising preflop and then betting us twice back-to-back. It's interesting because if you had made that raise, he would have folded. If you had called, you were saying we were probably going to face a 400 bet, but he didn't. He checked behind.
Well, I think that's the weakness in his play.
Yeah.
How do you check behind there? Your ace can't be good there, right? Somebody that raised preflop and called you all the way down.
Right.
You have to bet that river. I know it's scary. Again, sometimes you need squirrel nuts. You do.
Yeah.
And he really lost his hand because I don't know whether we could have called that, whatever, 600 or whatever we think it's going to be. I mean, maybe we do. I mean, the river was pretty safe for our hand. So, I don't know. But I think you had to take that shot on the end. I mean, you were waving the white flag there.
Yeah. Wow. Unbelievable.
Crazy. That's why I don't play cash games, folks.
You always say that.
All right, sign up at advancedpokertraining.com. Hand of the week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at antiupmagazine.com. If you haven't won something from us in the past year, you get a free membership to Advanced Poker Training, the world's number one poker training site. And as we mentioned last week, Brandon...
Huff. Like Charlie Huff.
Yeah, okay. Huff.
He hasn't written in to correct us, so I think it is Huff, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think he's probably just going to see for the next 8 weeks how many times we can debate how to pronounce his name. Brandon, our friend Brandon.
Right.
Sent us 8 hands. Last week we played the first of them, so this week is the second in his collection. And, boy, I got to get your little head out of my way here.
Sorry, as my head grew.
Oh, man. I can't move you.
See, I told you that people, now they're starting to see behind the curtain how the show actually works. You're staring at my face the whole time.
All right. Fortunately, you're only covering a little bit. Oh, hold on. There I go. Wow. I don't know. That's so weird. I've never been able to. Oh, there we go. Now I moved you. Okay. All right. So again, so this is a 1-2 live, no limit hold'em game.
Okay.
And Brendan is up to almost $300. The button has him covered, though it is difficult to get a good count. His red chips are in three super tall towers. Matt Savage isn't going to allow that, folks.
That's right.
Going to come by and knock that down. Stacks 20s, folks. I raised to, all right, sorry, I'm sorry. Middle position, one limper, and we have the seven of hearts, seven of spades.
It sounds like he wants to raise.
Yeah. Might have tipped my hand in a little bit.
I'm never really a big raiser with these types of hands. It just depends on what kind of table you're at, what kind of player you've presented. If you're saying, you know, I'm the type of guy who always raises when I come in, and he's been doing it all along, and that's your reputation, then, yeah, I might raise with this. If you're the type of guy that likes to just set mine and get in for the cheapest price possible because you're at a table that's passive, so they allow you to do that, I might just limp. It just depends. You know, you have one limper already, which means now you're going to have to raise. Most likely, you would probably want to raise to an amount that's even more than a traditional raise. So now you're committing more money with a pair of sevens, which is barely even a middle pair. It's not even really a middle pair. So, you know, to me, I like to just limp along, and then if somebody chooses to raise behind me, now it makes the raise a little smaller because somebody re-raises my raise. Now I'm getting into it for a ton for just a pair of sevens that, let's face it, it's not going to hit a flop, you know, most of the time. So for me, I like to just limp with these hands if I can, especially something like in middle position. It's one thing to be on the button and you've got the blinds behind you or the cutoff or something and you can represent anything. But it's another to have to get through all these people with a raise in middle position, which is 7-7. So I don't mind limping. It just depends on the persona you've shown at this table. So I'm going to limp, but you can do what you want.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, this is how you size up the game because I think you get two options here. Obviously, you can limp and set mine. And because we're in middle position, if we do that, we would hope to have more customers come along, right? When we hit our hand.
Right.
The other option is if you raise here and you feel pretty confident that your raise is going to clear the field other than the first player, now you're heads up, and now your sevens don't have to hit a seven. You can represent a wide range of hands after that. So, but I think it depends. I mean, if a raise is not being respected at this table, I'm not going to raise here. And so because the raise, I want to get heads up. If I can't get heads up, then I'm going to limp and set mine.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right. We raise to $11, as I telegraphed. And then there's a re-raise from the button to $20. The blinds and the limper fold, and it's back to us.
So that's basically a min-raise, right? Because it was 1-2, we made 11, so that was a raise of 9. So another raise of 9. So basically the guy min-raised us. At this point, you probably have to call, because now it's probably worth to see if you could pop a set. I don't necessarily like our hand right now. But again, these hands of the week, people don't understand how tough it is. First, we suck at poker, so that makes it difficult already. But then on top of it, I don't know what's going on at this table. Is the guy who re-raised, he's got a decent stack, he's got us covered, but is this the type of guy that just likes a 3-bet to force everybody out and have position on you because he knows you're probably going to check to him, and he's going to bet and take it and then move on? Or is he the guy that only does this when he has a hand that's better than sevens? So it's tough. If you're coming into this cold, you better hit that set before you get really committed to your stack. I just don't. You better hit the seven. So if you're going to call, it better be, even if it's all unders, you still can't be confident because this guy could be, who re-raises at a 1-2 game unless they're a player who understands that you play the player and you play position. And they're, if you're really that good at the game, a lot of times you're not even playing 1-2. So you really got to think this guy probably has a better hand than you. And you better pop that set. And if you don't, I wouldn't commit a lot of my funds to it, especially if somebody has me covered and in position. So yeah. I don't mind calling the $9 more. I got a decent stack in front of me. But if I miss it, and he bets, I'm probably out of there. If you bet something really small, I might want to spike a 7 on the turn. But really, going into this hand, you got to know, or into this flop, you got to know, if I don't hit my 7, I'm probably out of there if I get any kind of heat from this guy.
I'm with you. I can't fold here because, one, I need to have him respect me, right?
Yeah.
So if you fold here, then he's going to raise you every time and min raise too. If I knew that I could min raise you, Chris, every time you raised and you would fold, I would do it
every time. That's right. Right? That's so, absolutely right. Yeah.
So I think you need to take a stand here and at least call. But yeah, I'm going to be very cautious going forward because, as you mentioned, out of position and not with a great hand. So,
man, you made another good point. I got to give you a purple smiley face at the end of the show.
One more, I'll get a sucker.
Yeah, give you a little sticker too.
All right, so we do call. The pot is $45, and the flop is the 8 of clubs, 10 of clubs, 8 of spades, and we're first to act.
Well, given everything we've just said, I think a check is in order. I don't see how I could bet into this guy and waste money. You know, we didn't hit the flop. We didn't hit the flop on many levels. It'd have to go runner-runner for a straight, and you'd have the low end. So I don't see any benefit to betting out here. Especially if the guy has an overpair, then he's just going to make us pay. So check, and then hope he bets minimally or checks behind. Otherwise, we're done with this hand.
The good thing is this board gives us some opportunities to steal this pot later on if we want. So I am not going to bet out now. I will probably check call. I'll be happy if it goes check, check, because then I can really come alive on the turn, right? But these eights, the clubs, the straight cards, even though we were the first raiser, I think we have the ability to represent some part of this board later on in the hand if we want to be bold. So I like this flop. It's not the flop I wanted, but I like it better than other flops.
Yeah. I mean, if that's the game you're playing, I like to do those types of things in position. I don't like to try to represent stuff out of position, especially when, you know, we raised first and got re-raised and then just called. So we're already telling them, our hand isn't that big. For the most part, anybody in a 1-2 game who has a hand that's really big is going to pop it again and hope you have kings because your aces are going to take their whole stack. So in this case, we're already telling them we don't have a big hand. So yeah, could we represent connectors or one gappers, which is what it would need to be for a straight? I don't know. Can you represent an 8 in your hand? It's tough. You'd have to have quads, I think, at this point to really make this guy scared. Could you have 10-10? Probably. That's the hand that I would probably try to represent. Maybe the clubs, less ace-king of clubs, if the guy doesn't have that in his hand already. So other than that, it's pretty tough. So yeah, you better hope a club comes if you want to represent a hand. I don't think straight hands are going to be believable.
All right, we do check, and the villain bets $20.
You know, I might call to spike a 7 or a believable turn card that helps us. $20 is not that big a deal. You could try the old check raise there, make them believe you have an 8 somehow, like an ace 8, but, or, you know, I don't think you would do that with 10-10 because you'd want him to keep betting. I think a call is probably in order for one more street, but if we miss again, that's it, I'm done with the hand.
Yeah, I'm definitely calling here, I think. And I'm starting to get a little bit of a profile of this villain. Maybe I'm wrong, but the min raise in a cash game is really odd to me, pre-flop, right? Hmm. Now, this flop bet, it's a little less than half the pot, so it's probably not terribly out of line, but I probably would have expected a bigger bet from this guy here. So I'm beginning to think, I'm trying to put together a profile here, and he seems to be more timid than I think a general player would be, which makes me think that I have a better chance of pushing him off this hand if a card comes on the turn that makes the board look scarier, or, you know, our dream 7 as well too. So but we'll see where it goes, but that's my initial reaction to this player. So I don't think he's sitting on aces or kings or queens here. I think he can be manipulated. So all right, our hero says, the preflop raise smelled like a big pair to me. The small raise got my radar up. The villain has been doing a lot of shoving late in the hands, but not seeing many showdowns. He has been winning, too. He was there for the same hour and a half I've been. Okay. Well, maybe not as timid as I thought then. But He says, I'm hoping to pick up a draw with a 6, a 9, or a jack, maybe a club so I could bluff that I hit the flush, or my 2-outer with a 7. Lots of ways that board could run out that would make life suck for someone holding a high pair, so I called. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Right.
I think some potential here. So.
Right.
Pot is $85 now, and the turn is the 7 of diamonds, so our board now is 8 of clubs, 10 of clubs, 8 of spades, 7 of diamonds. Ricky Tiki Tavi, right?
Or as I say, Ricky Tiki Taffy. I didn't understand what it was when I first heard it, so sorry. Yeah, that's huge. I would check again now, because there's so many reasons to not bet. Pretty obvious.
Yep, absolutely. This is a dream for us. Unless we're up against some, what would it have to be, 9-jack?
Doesn't even matter. We have a full house.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Yep. So what's our play here? Are we checking to check raise?
Well, you could check raise if you're...
Or check to check call. Make him alive on the river.
Yeah, if you're convinced that he would... if you're convinced he has an overpair and that he is the type of guy... Because he said something before in your last comment about he tends to shove later in hands. I might just check call or check and see if he shoves.
Right? Yep.
Yeah. And then if I knew that he would shove if I re-raised, check raised, then I would probably check raise. If I thought I would scare him off, I would. It's a more of a feel thing. But since the guy likes to shove late in hands, I might just call and see when the river comes. You might bet a little bit, look like you're stealing it, and then he shoves on you. Then you got him. So I don't know. I guess it would just have to be a gut feeling when I'm at the table. But I'm definitely not betting out.
All right, our hero checks as well, too, and the villain bets $35.
Okay, so we've just talked about it all. So, I mean, it depends on the moment. If I'm going to raise, I'm going to make it like 100. If I'm not going to raise, that's the problem, is on the river now, do you check and let him get away, or do you bet out on the river? And so,
well, again, he's doing exactly what I said he was doing. I mean, $35 into an $85 pot now after a min raise pre-flop and a less than a half-size pot, half-pot. But, we're going to drag the chips out of this guy's hand, I think. So, I mean, unless he does this shoving thing that apparently he's done in the past, he just really doesn't seem like he wants to put a lot of money in this pot. So, I don't think I can call and check the river and have him either check behind or put out another ridiculously small bet. I mean, I guess at that point, if he puts out a ridiculously small bet, then we could check raise then. But I think now's the time to come alive. So, if he's got anything... Let's raise, and then he can shove on us, and I'll be happy with that. If not, we're not going to lose any value because it doesn't seem like this guy's going to put any more money in, or very little. So
you want to raise?
I think I'm going to raise now.
Yeah, I think I might raise too. The turn is where you make your money. Let's raise.
All right, we raise to $105.
Yeah.
The villain thinks for a minute and then shoves.
Wow. Well, a snap call in there. I can't fold.
And, of course, our hero says, I snap call. We show our sevens for the full house. The river was the ace of hearts and the villain mucks. I was really expecting to see ace there, not a muck, but I'll take it. Though he looked as though he had already lost when I slapped a 7-7 on the felt before the river was dealt. That was odd, too. What did he have? I assume it was only king-king with some queen-queen, maybe, but I don't expect him to play queen-queen that way very often. Seems like... he was played too trappy for queen-queen, possibly ace of clubs, king of clubs, or ace of clubs, queen of clubs.
No.
Maybe I was fixated on the min 3 bet too much, maybe narrowed his range too much. One more detail, he spent the next 20 minutes going over and over that hand, replaying the action to himself, talking to himself and the players next to him. That also reinforced the idea that he had a big pair there, and that he thought my play was really weird. Was it reasonable to call the flop? I had to raise the turn to have a shot at getting stacks in. Was the shove on the turn a pure bluff? That might explain the crestfallen look I saw at my full house before the river was dealt. Thinking about that, after coming back to this for a while, I guess Jack 9 makes sense. Post-flop, bet the draw on the flop, bet the turn when he hits, and he shoves, thinking I'm on a semi-bluff with a flush draw or a big pair of my own. Then he's just done when I turn over my hand. Drawing totally dead. Still makes no sense pre-flop. Jack 9's it.
I don't think Jack 9's it. One, he re-raised you. Two, he waited until he saw the ace to muck, because if he knew you had sevens full, there's no hand that comes that wins for him, so you would have mucked already. I don't think that's it. I don't think it was ace-king or ace-queen, because he might have thought the ace would have won, but you showed the 7-7. So again, why is he waiting to see the river? You already have full house, so clubs didn't matter. So I think it was the king-king. I think it was king-king, and it didn't matter what happened on the river. He was waiting for a king, didn't see the king, and then mucked. So yeah, it feels like it was king-king. Maybe queen-queen, but probably king-king.
Good detective work there.
Yeah. It just feels like those other things. It's the story. It's the story we always talk about on the show. What does the story add up? And those scenarios, jack-nine especially, does not add up. Nobody three bets with jack-nine off unless you're, you know, Jamie Gold. And so I just think that there's no way this guy, you know, and even then, does he really shove on a paired board for with just a straight and a wet board of two clubs when, you know what I mean, you're willing to put 105 out there, you're probably willing to call another 200 if you're on a draw with one card to come and there's like 700 out there or whatever. So I think it's king-king or maybe queen-queen, but queen-queen was a little... You know, I don't think you could be too bold with queen-queen because you got two pairs that beat you. King-king, you could probably think you're ahead. So, felt like king-king to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think the more you talk, the more it has to be king-king. Because here's the thing, what's the upside of this shoving after we raise? What does he think we have that we're raising with there?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we have to have a made hand, and that's a scary board. So, I'm like, I guess the best he has to hope for is we're with queen-queen. And he has the kings, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because we're also, when you think about it, we also could have an eight. And so his king is losing to any eight. You know, you have ace, eight suited, you raise. And everyone raises with a suited ace in middle position. And then all of a sudden, boom, you re-raise minimally. So he's like, well, I'm going to take a flyer with a suited ace here. And if I hit the eight, you know. So he could have had an eight, too. So really, I mean, this guy... I think the shove was more of his protocol, thinking he'd get away with it. And then, you know, but the king, if he had a made hand, it'd be king-king. If he was just outright bluffing, then it could have been something like ace-queen. No, it wouldn't even be that because the ace came in there. So it had to be king-king. What else could it be, really?
Yeah, I think this really keeps reminding me of the when Andy Duke was teaching Ben Affleck how to play, right? And she taught him, hey... You're not just aggressive, you have to be aggressive in the right spots.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think if this guy's MO, which it sounds like it is shoving a lot to push people off of hands, that's great, but you have to do it in hands where it makes sense. This is not a hand where it makes sense.
Right.
You're looking at that board, I mean, unless we are completely crazy, we've got something that has you beat right now. And that shove is not going to get us to go away. It's just not. It's just going to cost you more money. And then you got to hope for that spike, that king on the river. Oh, he probably really should have folded his kings there.
Yeah, yeah. I think he can get away with the call because it was only another 60-something or whatever on the turn, right? And then when the ace comes, then he feels even better. He's like, okay, ace beat me on top of it, so I'm just going to get out of the way here when he shoves on me or bets the river. But to just shove there, that's just desperation. Or, I mean, he maybe legitimately thought he had the best hand somehow. I don't know, but it seemed like it was his MO.
But that's what I'm saying, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
You shouldn't there. You really shouldn't.
I agree.
You have the best hand there. So, and I really don't know what he's confused about other than he just hoped if he did have king-king, you just always assume that you're going to win with that if an ace doesn't come, right?
Right.
Because, I mean, the raise, the pre-flop raise, maybe that's why it was so small because he wanted to get action, which I always think is a bad idea, right? So, I mean, you can't fault us for calling that min raise, right? So... And then the flop comes, and it is that weird board where we can play back at him.
Yeah.
I don't think he can legitimately be upset at how we played this.
No, he misplayed this the whole way, especially, like, you know, when you're looking for the action. And then he also couldn't really rule out ace-ace with us. People will do that often. They'll raise with ace-ace, see somebody behind them raising, and then they just call to be cute. They do that a lot too, especially in games where they're not really that good in 1-2 game or something. They do that a lot. They try to get tricky with their ace-ace. A lot of times it bites them in the ass, but in this case, he could have had ace-ace there, and you still were losing with king-king. The guy played it wrong the whole way. I think he should have, yeah, he should have lost a lot less than he did. He should have just gotten out.
Again, everything we're hearing, again, from Brendan here about this player just makes me think that he's not a very strong player, and he probably thinks he's stronger than he really is.
So. Sure, he has three super tall tower stacks, apparently. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. Well, at least he won. That's always good for our show when our guys are winning. That means they stick around. Thanks, Brandon. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Lodge.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.